Okay, go. Thank you all for coming here. I'm sorry for the last minute change we had to do for our schedule. So we had to evade from last week's, from yesterday's schedule. Today, we won't be talking about the exercises, but really just about the lecture. Vanna, there's another chair. The reason for that is I initially planned to squeeze both together into one session, but I don't think that will work out very well because the next series of exercises will be more complex than the previous ones, and I would like to spend some more time discussing the previous times and explaining the next ones. So we'll do all those exercises next week. And yeah, I would like to catch up with the lecture because the lecture is not in schedule, the exercises are, even if we shift them to next week. Before we start with the actual lecture, I would like to pick up some questions asked last week. Someone asked if Nehalem was also an architecture which featured an onboard graphics core from Intel. Actually, it didn't, but its successor, Westmere, I really just dug that up from Wikipedia. Its successor, Westmere, did contain a graphics core which was attached to the memory controller. So if you recall Intel's tick-tock rhythm of propagating new architectures, you may remember that Westmere was not a new microarchitecture, but the die shrink of Nehalem. So very few things were changed. And this is probably also an explanation why the graphics core was attached to the memory controller instead of moving it here into the core part of the CPU, because this way they could make those changes with minimal impact on the actual CPU design. Today, the graphics core is usually attached to the last level cache, level 3 cache, for most architectures from Intel. So newer microarchitectures have changed the way graphics cores are integrated, but Westmere was the first to feature an on-chip graphics core. Before we start with the actual lecture, I have I would like to tell you something from my research life. You probably know when you're doing software engineering that you should write unit tests to test if your code or at least your functions are doing what you expect them to do. And you should also run them in automated fashion. What few people do is performance testing. So quite often when I'm talking to my colleagues, they say performance testing is something they will do for the next release, or before they publish a new release, they do some performance testing. But usually, in my experience, that's too late, because if you have been working for 3 months and you've been changing your code a lot, and you suddenly realize that your code is running just half the speed of a previous release, I'm not sure if you really want to dig through thousands of lines of code to see which change actually caused the performance degradation. So my view is, if you're testing for functionality, you should also test for performance, at least if you're doing HPC. And this should be done automated on different platforms, and all the time, basically. What I'm showing you here is from my own library, a performance plot. And usually I just care for this line, which should be red, and this should be green, actually. But anyway, and yeah, what happened is somewhere around the 17th of November, performance dropped. When I saw this first, I wasn't really sure what happened. I took a look at my log, and I discovered that I didn't actually change the code. So the same code was running on the same machine, suddenly with one third less performance, which was really surprising to me. So I dug through the log files of that machine to figure out what happened, and actually it was rebooted at that time. So something changed in the system configuration. I tried to figure out what changed in the system configuration, but actually there was no change, at least none I could discover. So yesterday I was really frustrated. You probably remember when I was sitting in the same room with you. What happened yesterday evening was our head node also rebooted. I'm not sure why that was. I think it ran out of memory. And the watchdog kicked in. Anyhow, so I reran the performance tests. Just a second. And from this morning, the performance test looked like this. So it's all back to normal. Actually, it's a bit above that, because when I was debugging my performance tests, I also discovered that I wasn't doing any process pinning. So now process pinning is in place. Does anyone know what process pinning means? Okay, we'll discuss that in the next lecture, in the next exercises. Basically, this just means that by process pinning, I can prevent a process from jumping between different cores. Usually, the operating system is free to decide on which core to run a process. If you're doing HPC, you typically don't want to jump to different cores, because in that case, the cache might be thrashed, because your code might have put all the data it needs into a level 1 and level 2 cache. When it gets scheduled to another core, that core doesn't have that data in level 1 and level 2 cache. So that spoils your performance. Anyhow, so what can we learn from this? Performance testing, you need to do it continuously, because it's not just your code which may impact performance. It's also the machine configuration. It's even the weather. When it's hot outside, it gets hot in our server room. And when it's like 40 degrees behind this glass window, the turbo mode might not be activated in the CPU. But when it's winter and when it's really cold, the CPU can actually clock higher, because it has more thermal headroom. OK, so much from my research experience. Let's jump back to the slides. I think we left somewhere in the Nehalem architecture, actually pretty close to the end of the Nehalem architecture. So somewhere, I think somewhere here did we stop, right? Okay. So the good thing is, oops. Just a second. The good thing is, that was actually the last slide of the Nehalem architecture. What we are talking now about is the cell processor. Does anyone know what the cell processor is?
The processor in the PlayStation 3.
Exactly.
So it's a heterogeneous processor with one or two main cores and more smaller cores, which are just for computational performance there.
Yeah. So in computer architecture, people were thinking about heterogeneous designs for actually quite a while, for years, even decades. But on the commercial market, there was no heterogeneous chip design. And the cell CPU was primarily designed by IBM for use in the PlayStation 3. IBM has a long history of designing custom cores for industry applications and even for entertainment electronics. So perhaps you remember that the first PlayStation was also using an IBM chip. No, sorry, not the first PlayStation, the first Xbox. So IBM did not just design for Sony, but also for Microsoft. It's probably a random event or just coincidence that now AMD is supplying the chips for both PlayStation and Xbox. But yeah, that's a different story. OK, so well, what was special about the cell CPU? As you said, it was a heterogeneous design. So it did feature a more or less standard core. And attached to this standard core with an on-chip network was were so-called SPEs, which we will see in the next slides. The reason why this gaming chip is important for HPC is it is one of the first chips which were reused for HPC. With slight modifications, this was used for the first petaflop machine, which we'll see, I think, next week. So without further ado, let's continue. As I said before, the Cell BE is a heterogeneous design. This significantly differs from classic multicores from AMD and Intel, even though we could say that today's Intel designs with on-chip graphics cores could also be seen as a heterogeneous design, especially when we can program them via OpenCL. One interesting aspect of the Cell CPU was that the peak performance, I think the design is now how old? 8 years? Perhaps not, perhaps 6 years. So compared to today's CPUs, it's really old. But still, its performance isn't bad. So it can really compare with what I can buy today for a notebook or even for a workstation. And the reason for this is it had one, as you said, one traditional core and 8 SIMD units. So these were actually very reduced cores. You could call them actually RISC cores, which didn't have much capability. They didn't have much memory for their code. And they had some local memory, but they had to share this for both the code and the data, which made coding for them really difficult. But I would like to skip ahead to the first diagram. I could now tell you the details, and that's probably not so interesting, especially that's not relevant for the exam. So this is a die plot of the actual CPU. This is the power PC element. This is a traditional core which you can program just like any other core which will just run your compiled code. It's based on a power PC architecture, which is also a standard architecture from IBM. You should not confuse power PC with power or PC. So it's capitalized with the first P, and the trailing PC is also capitalized. This is actually different from IBM Power, which is all caps. And it's also very different from PC, so the traditional hardware we're using for PCs. I'm not sure why IBM decided to call this architecture Power PC, because I think Power did precede it, and PC did also precede the Power PC. I think it was back then a marketing term because IBM tried to retake the PC market with its Power PC architecture. However, they didn't really gain traction. I'm not sure if anyone ever bought an actual personal computer powered with a Power PC CPU, but the basic design, the instruction set architecture, was reused for many different purposes. One of them being the first Xbox, if I remember correctly. Does anyone know for in which case these PC, these CPUs were also used? Embedded systems, actually. So you can, or at least some years ago, you could buy a lot of washing machines which were using Power PC CPUs, simply because they could reduce the design so into such a small scale that they could produce them very cheaply and they would be running very efficiently. They didn't use much power. Today, of course, this market has been overrun by ARM designs. Okay, so what I'm trying to say is the actual die is too large. That's probably a standard die size. And from this, just a very small part was taken up for the Power PC element. Also, a very small part is taken up by the level 2 cache. Usually, if you look at today's die plots, we can get you another chair. Is the door over there open? Yep. Okay, so what I'm trying to say is traditional Intel designs, which you can buy today, typically spend more than half of the die space for caches. And for the Cell CPU, that was really just a small part. And the major part here is actually spent on the SPEs, the synergistic processing elements, which we'll take a look at on the next slides. Each of these components was connected by a ring bus, this here doesn't perhaps really look like a ring bus, but logically it was a one-dimensional ring bus. Anyhow, who remembers Rambus? Thanks. Rambus was a company, I think they tried to revolutionize the way PCs are using memory 10 years ago. But their problem was they were patenting, they had patents on all the interesting architectures or design decisions they made. And this made their technology very expensive because, of course, they wanted to profit from this. So major vendors did not use Rambus, at least for PC hardware, because PC was always open. The standards were always open, and almost everyone before the patent war started, at least, could publish CPUs or memory modules for this for these architectures. But IBM did license the Rambus design, and this memory controller here, even though the CPU is so old, can actually compete with my memory controller in my current notebook, which is just a year old. Okay, maybe 2 years, but still way younger than the cell design. Okay. Oops. Okay, one point I wasn't sure about. The cell CPU design is actually 9 years old, at least when you consider the production, the first date where it was fixed. So this is basically the same which we just saw before, but in this case, the we can easily tell which parts are connected to which. As I said before, this is PowerPC element. So this diagram is wrong. It's not based on the power architecture, but on the PowerPC architecture. Actually, it's, I think the power. I will have to look it up, which model it is exactly. It's got its own level 1 cache and level 2 cache, so the SPEs cannot easily access this level 2 cache. All other elements are connected via a ring bus. This here is the memory controller. So this is not the Intel mic. It's got nothing to do with Xeon Phi. It's really just the memory controller. Does anyone know what this BIC means? It stands for Bus Interface Controller, or Bus Interconnect Controller. And this can be used to connect multiple cell CPUs together. So actually, one of our blades, which we have three cell blades, and each cell blade has two cell CPUs on it, and they are connected via the BIC. If you compare this to Intel designs, this would be the QPI bus. For AMD, this would be HyperTransport. This is an even more detailed look of the architecture. What's not so much interesting is these parts. Usually you just use the power processing element for loading the code onto the SPEs. So this is more a controller. It's less used for actual computations. Memory controller, oh yeah, bus interface controller. So it's not interconnect, but bus interface controller. The really interesting parts are these SPEs. And what you can see here is they consist of the actual execution unit, local store, LS means local store. This is a local scratch pad, very small memory on which they can store intermediate data and also their code. The problem here is, as I said before, if you have a large kernel, this competes in size with the data. So typically you can decide, do I want to put much data onto the core, or would I prefer to put more code in it? Would I like to perform more complex calculations? The more complex calculations I can perform in local store, the less data I have to move through the memory controller, which can actually be a bottleneck here. So another strategy was to put different code on the different SPEs and perform one step of the computation here, pass on data to the next SPE, and so on, so the local store could be used more efficiently. What's also interesting here is the DMA units. So the SPEs did not have to use their own execution unit for moving data to neighboring SPEs or to main memory, but they could just tell the DMA unit, hey, please transfer data starting at address X for Y bytes and transfer those to whatever destination they chose. This has one obvious benefit. If the hardware does this for me, my code doesn't have to do it, and also my CPU is free to do other computations. The downside is the programmer had to do this actually, and had to manually program those, which was efficient but complicated. So programmers did really hate this machine. It's also the differences between this design and the designs we see today is also one reason why PlayStation 4 cannot play PlayStation 3 games, because they would have to emulate this, and that doesn't work very well. It's theoretically possible, so if you look at the emulator scene for PCs, you can see some emulators for PlayStation 3. They are all really just in their infancy. They are not, most of them are not working in a stable fashion. They are not necessarily as fast as they would need to be. Because one interesting thing is, the CPU is running at, I think, 3.2 gigahertz. So it's still a bit faster than most CPUs you would find, at least in a notebook or in most gaming PCs. You can, of course, buy faster CPUs today from Intel, but they are still expensive. You can buy, I think, up to 3.7 gigahertz. Not sure if you can buy much faster CPUs. Okay, we won't go too much into detail of the actual cell architecture, because I removed that part from the exercise. In previous instances of this lecture, we would actually try to run some code on these cell CPUs, but because they are now so old and more of interest from a historic perspective, but not for current machines, actually the first petaflop machine has been phased out a couple of months ago. So we just look briefly at this. If you are more interested in it, you can download the slides and study them in detail, or discuss them with me aside from the lecture. Okay, this was what I was referring to before. The bandwidth of the cell BE was 25 gigabytes. I think my notebook has something like 16 gigabytes. So it's really, really fast. And what's also really fast is the bus intercon. What was it called? Bus interface control. Thanks. The ring bus itself is very fast. And if you remember the Halem design, that was also using a ring bus to connect the cores. And more modern architectures from Intel are using the ring bus not just to connect the cores, but also partitions of a level 3 cache. And what we see today is that this ring bus doesn't scale. It didn't scale for the Xeon Phi, which we'll take a look on in the next lectures. It did not scale even for the current Xeon CPUs, which have up to, I think, 18 cores. So what Intel did for the Haswell EP, Haswell EP is the latest range of Intel server processors. What they did was, they did start off with the traditional ring bus design, where each core had its own level 1 cache, level 2 cache, and a partition for a level 3 cache. And when they try to add more cores, as I said, they have, I think, at most 18 cores, they just added another ring bus and then interfaced both ring buses by something which you could compare to the BIC on the cell BE. So one interesting thing about supercomputer architectures is it all repeats. It all comes back, right? So we've seen this 10 years ago, and today Intel's designs are very similar from the from an architectural point of view. We will also see some similarities later on between GPUs and the vector CPUs, which were used in the 1980s. Okay, so as I said, if you're really interested in the cell CPU, you can take a look on those slides later on. I think we even have a code sample further below. This is probably interesting. I was before telling you that the SPEs have very limited RAM, so they actually have 256 kilobytes of local SRAM. This was very fast, but if you think that your, but if you consider your code has probably something like 50 kilobytes, that's already a sizable part of the total local local store. What's been pleasant is that there were a lot of registers, 128. Does anyone remember, or does anyone know how many AVX registers I can use, for instance, on an Haswell EP? Sorry?
60?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. So, well, I think for SSE, for AVX, they did keep the same number. Yeah. So compare this from current Intel CPU with 16 registers to 128. That's quite a bit more. If you then remember that you're usually trying to keep as much data in registers as you can, these registers can actually be very useful. Of course, these 16 registers for Haswell is a bit misleading because Haswell can do out-of-order execution. And if you remember what we were talking about for the scoreboard and Tomozulu algorithm, you may remember that those out-of-order execution algorithms can actually imply that registers need to be copied. So there are shadow copies of registers, which are in hardware just normal registers. So in reality, Haswell has much more registers, but they are not accessible to the programmer. So you could say that the difference between this architecture and this architecture is this architecture forces the programmer to do everything manually, but it also gives him a lot of control. So if you're very skilled in programming a code, you can achieve a much higher performance years before another architecture comes out, which tries to do all these optimizations for you in hardware. Because it can do out-of-order execution, because it can do much more register scheduling, because it hides the complexity of memory access by just giving you caches which do all of this transparently. Yeah. Okay, this is a code sample. I would just like to give you a very brief overview. In a way, the way the cell CPU was programmed is very similar to how people use today OpenCL for programming GPUs. So the code is actually split into two parts. One is compiled for the SPE, the vector units, and the other part is compiled for the host CPU. That's really the same as we do it for OpenCL. And actually, just a couple of years after the original programming standard for cell was published, they canceled all these tools and said, please use our OpenCL implementation because it works just the same, but perhaps a bit easier. And the result was, because this OpenCL implementation was another layer of indirection, people were no longer able to achieve the same degree of efficiency on a cell CPU, but they still have the same problems. Anyhow, so this is a brief sample. This is running actually on the power processing element, so it's not running on the SPE. What it does is it basically tries to establish a context on the SPEs and runs the code there. And I think on the next slide we can see the kernel. Yeah, so this would be running on the kernel. It doesn't do much, it really just prints out its own thread ID. The problem with cell was you did need a lot of wire-up code. So on the previous slide, you could see this is the wire-up code required to actually create threads on the SPEs and load code on them and establish data buffers for moving data between those. So it's been complicated. And people don't really like complex wire up combined with the complexity of actually using those SPEs. Because if you remember, those vector units here, this data here looks impressive, right? Many registers, many flops, local store which can be accessed efficiently. This should look like a very efficient architecture. The problem is the pipelines here and the execution unit were in order designs, and the front end was very limited. The front end could launch instructions to two pipelines. These two execution pipelines were called odd and even pipeline, and it could issue an instruction only to one of these per cycle, and it even had to alternate between those every cycle. So in every odd cycle could issue an instruction here, in every even cycle it could issue an instruction here, and the programmer had to take care that the assembly instructions would be mixed in that way that every instruction for this cycle would be able to be issued here, and every second cycle other instructions would be able to schedule here. And that's really complicated, because in that case, if you wanted to write really efficient code for cell, you always had to take a look on the assembly code. IBM did even publish a simulator for these pipelines, so you could run it on your own PC to see if your instruction mix would match this front-end design. As I said, complicated. But people even did it. So if you would ask someone who's been developing games for PlayStation 3, they probably know about this, because game developers have a long history of optimizing code for actual hardware, really optimizing it to the maximum, because that's their main selling point. I would like to see, yeah, okay. So I think this is actually a diagram from the odd and even pipeline. And the issue path could either issue a command here in this pipeline or here. This is here really for most calculations, especially for the floating point calculations. But if you want to execute a branch function, load and store, sometimes you really need to move data out of the CPU, even if you have 128 registers. Or if you want to do a thing, just scalar integer logic, you can do this in the even in the odd pipeline. Actually, this is something people are right now complaining about Haswell EP. Haswell EP did increase the width of data paths, so now you can execute more. Now you can fetch more data from level one cache into registers, and you can move more data back. This was a huge increment from the previous microarchitectures. One problem is now there are so many pipelines in the Haswell EP microarchitecture, and the data paths are wide enough to actually satisfy those pipelines, but now the front end is too narrow. So you cannot actually issue one load instruction, one store instruction, and two compute instructions simultaneously. So right now, the actual microarchitecture is so efficient that the front end did not keep up with this. This is a development which did bug AMD designs in the past years. So we'll have to see if Intel can improve on this in the next years. Okay, but so much for the cell CPU. We will return to cell in, I think, next week, when we'll take a look on the first petaflop system. Okay, so much for the third chapter in the lecture. This is now the fourth chapter. And in the beginning of the term, I said that the first part of the lecture would be focused on studying architectures. What we'll do now is we'll move way back and take a look on important systems, important number one systems on the top 500 list. And actually, we will start in 2001 with the ASCII wide, even though probably our focus will be on 2002 on the Earth simulator. Did I tell you what the top 500 list is? Or does everyone know what the top 500 list is? Does anyone not know? OK, that's good. So taking the top spot on the top 500 list is associated with a bit of privilege, or at least prestige. And does anyone know in which country currently the fastest system is? China, exactly. The Qianhe 2? How would you pronounce it?
It's just like
really? Thank you. You're too kind. I'm pretty sure it was not pronounced well. But yeah. I think at least for Germans, it's a difficult language because we don't hear much of what we are trained or what our ears are trained to. In October, or more in September, I was in Japan. So, of course, Japanese is a very different language from Mandarin or other Chinese languages. But still, what was surprising me is I was trying to pronounce names correctly. And I was talking to one of the Japanese people who were hosting me. And I was asking where I should put the stress on the word. And he said, it doesn't really matter. You can pronounce it in whatever way you want. What's important is that the sound itself is unchanged. And if you remember how we in Germany stress our words, it's very important, right? And the same goes for, I think, most Indo-Germanic languages. So if someone is pronouncing a word with a stress on not the first syllable, but perhaps on the last syllable, I might not even understand it, even though it's using the same sounds. So different languages, different features are important. Anyway, back to supercomputers. Until November 2001, we had on the first spot the ASCII wide system located in Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. We will hear this name Lawrence Livermore quite often in the remaining lecture because many systems were located there. And actually, also we will hear this national laboratory term quite often. Do you know what the national laboratories are in the US? Those are major research institutions with different scopes. Lawrence Livermore is doing, one of Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory's main missions is a nuclear weapons stewardship. Did I tell you about nuclear weapons stewardship before? Okay, so basically, you know, nuclear weapons have is it plutonium? Is it pronounced that way? Okay. Inside them, most are built from this, as far as I know. And we have decay in plutonium, right? So if you put it on a shelf and you wait for 10,000 years, you will take back plutonium from this because it has lost mass, because its atoms did decay. Now, the question is, if I'm not waiting for 10,000 years, but probably just for 50 years, will this nuclear bombs still work? I should know, right? Because if I have a couple hundred warheads sitting in my rocket silos, I probably don't want them to not work any longer. Or I probably don't want them to just combust without me taking any action, right? So what they do is, decades ago, you could just take a nuclear warhead and try to explode it, and you could from that tell what its state was. And if you have thousands of them, and if you have thousands of South Sea islands which you can let go to waste, that's probably not so much of a problem. But today this is politically not that much accepted. So people try to avoid actually igniting nuclear warheads. And what they do is they carry out those simulations on computers. And this is one of the major missions of Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. They have huge machines to carry out simulations of how nuclear weapons decay when they are just stored. And yeah, so that's good for everyone, right? We get huge machines to play with, and we don't have to bomb innocent islands any longer. So that's good. Actually, Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory did also some other crazy projects, but I probably shouldn't talk about those now. But let's just spare them for next lectures, because unless you can Google for Project Pluto if you want to have an entertaining afternoon. Anyhow, so ASCII-wide was one of the fastest systems. Then along came the Japanese and had their Earth simulator. And everyone was flashed, because the number one system used to be an American system for years. I'm not even sure if this was the first non-American system, but even if it wasn't the first, it was still a huge shock for the US. And there are reasons why this was a shock. It wasn't just slightly faster than ASCII-wide, but what you can see here on the gigaflops scale is, actually this is teraflops, right? 7,300 gigaflops is 7.3 teraflops. And the Earth simulator has had 35.8 teraflops. So it's faster by a margin of almost 5. That's a lot. So I think in the history of supercomputing, the step up from on the number one spot was never that large again. Today it's really just maybe a factor of two, but not more. Even a factor of two is today something drastic. Interestingly, I think the current number one system, the Tianhe 2, is pretty much exactly 1,000 times faster than the Earth simulator. So in 12 years, we have three orders of magnitude in growth. And also interesting, if you remember that I've been with our students in New Orleans a couple of weeks ago, our system was around that speed. So our system was really just, if you put it on table, it was probably this high. So just a couple of height units of 19-inch rack space. And it was as fast as the fastest supercomputer back then. So you could also say we can now build systems which are 1,000 times faster than the Earth simulator. But we can also build systems which are 1,000 times smaller than the ASCII-wide. Yeah. OK, so let's continue. One interesting aspect was, before that, supercomputers used to be housed in some basement or something which simply happened to be free. So if you Google for ASCII-wide, you will see that they actually put it in some basement which did not look very impressive. And the Japanese said, if we are now building such a huge system, we probably should put it in a proper building. And this was also one of the first systems which were used to display power or capability. So this is not just some building which they had to build to find enough space, but it was also designed to look good, which we'll see on the next slides. What's also interesting, because Japan is not really in a friendly part of the Earth, they had to take some precautions. So the whole system, the whole building is on shock absorbers, so it doesn't crash if there's a huge earthquake. And they actually have three floors, which should be perhaps a bit surprising, because we can see only two floors here. Oops. Ah, sorry. Okay, so on the upper floor, we have the actual systems with some network nodes here in the middle. We have the power supply and air condition system in the lower level. And this here, this is actually another floor. What do you think, how high is this floor? It's about 2 meters. So this is really just a floor for running the cables. Now, when I'm talking about running cables, let's step back for a moment. This is the building for the actual machine. It had its own power plant sitting next to it, because the machine was using so much power. This is actually even true for modern supercomputers. They use as much power as a small city would use. And this building here is for the people who are using the system. So they they could access it, of course, remotely. Okay, so 6.4 megawatts of power. I'm not sure how many megawatts you need to house to power houses. But that would be an interesting interesting calculation. It had 640 nodes. You don't have to learn all these numbers by heart, right? I will never ever ask those in a lecture, in an exam. What's interesting here is current machines have a couple tens of thousands of nodes, probably 20,000 nodes. So what we can see is current systems did not just scale the number of nodes, but each node also got a lot more capable. And this was what I was referring to before. This is the small flaw, which was hardly noticeable in the previous slides. This is really just used for running cables. And what you can see is it's probably not a very pleasant place to work in, because there are so many cables and you can always trip over cables. And I would not want to be the person who had to debug the system if one of the cable breaks. A couple of slides ago, I was saying that the system was also built to look good. So if you remember Japan's flag, it closely resembles Japan's flag. So what you can see here in dark blue are the compute nodes. In light blue are the interconnect network, which we'll talk about in the next slides, because this was really important. And the disks here are in gray. So they did also spend some time and effort to make it look appealing. Now, one thing which makes the Earth simulator special is not just that it was so much faster than SQWhite, but also that it was the last system to use a custom designed CPU, and the last system to use a full crossbar. Full crossbar means that every node can access every other node by just one hop through the network. So interesting about this is it's of course very fast, right? Because whatever communication pattern I need, it's directly supported by the network. One downside is if I have n nodes, I need O of n square cables. It's probably something like O times, depending on if I'm using bidirectional cables or unidirectional cables, I need something like n times n minus 1 half. This is probably the exact number of cables, but it depends. So sometimes nodes might need more cables because I would like to implement multiple directions simultaneously. But still, this is quite a lot. So for 640 nodes, we could estimate that the number of cables is probably something like this. How much would that be? I would estimate something like 768,000 cables. Okay, so 400,000. Oh well, at least the order of magnitude was right? So okay, so we can estimate for this system we would need about 400,000 cables. Now let's imagine I would like to recable the Tianhe 2 system. I think it has 20,000 nodes. Let's just assume it has 20,000 nodes. How many cables do I need? That was a question directly for you. So it's about 400 million. So even if you consider this to be an effort which you can do, it's probably not possible to buy 400 million cables on the commercial market right now for a supercomputer. And even if it was viable, you probably wouldn't want to pay that. So what I'm trying to say is this network here is very efficient. I think we even have some, yeah, here's a slide on the interconnect network. It is very efficient, but it doesn't scale. If you increase the number of nodes, it's simply not economical to build such a huge cable network. And if you remember the previous slide, these are the interconnect cables, the switches which manage all the connections. And yeah, we were estimating this, but actually we were overestimating here because they assume that you just need a connection to the next switch, and even though all processing nodes are connected to each network switch, they are using less switches than actual processing nodes. So this is why they were able to save some cables. So this is a reduction by a factor of 5, but still the complexity class n square holds true. Let's dive into the details of the system. I hope next week that I'll be able to figure out how my monitor connection works. I'm sorry. Okay, so I said before that the Earth simulator was also special because it was the last system to use a custom designed CPU. Today, designing a new CPU is simply too expensive, so people are really just reusing designs available for the consumer market and adapting those for supercomputers. For the Earth simulator, this was different. This is a single CPU which had multiple vector units. These vector units had their own load and store unit, vector registers, and different masks. And it also had a scalar unit. Now, if you remember the cell CPU, this should ring a bell, right? Because it's very similar. We also had 8 vector units. They had different names, right? They did have local store, but in a way, the design is very similar. The idea to move most computational load to the vector units and just use the scalar unit for control tasks is not new. This is something people did since the 1980s. So, and because it had so many vector units and those vector units were using wide vector words, they were able to squeeze out a lot of performance from these CPUs. What's also interesting is the peak power of this chip was 140 watts. And if you buy a CPU from Intel today, I think the typical power consumption of the flagship models is also something around 135 watts. So very close to this. The reason for this is about the amount of heat you can remove through air cooling. If you need to remove more excess heat from the CPU, you will need water cooling or even other cooling modes. So you can also use submersive cooling, which was also a technology pioneered, I think, from Cray in the 1970s. Right? But if you want to sell a CPU which can be cooled by air cooling, which Intel has to do because most people are still using air cooling for their CPUs, you cannot exceed this 140 watts by much. Okay, so much for the Earth simulator. The Earth simulator did hit the top 500 in 2002. And it did stay there for quite a while until BlueJean arrived. So one interesting aspect of BlueJean is its architecture was built to be extensible. So they started building it up even before 2004, and they were installing more and more cabinets, and they did not want another Earth simulator to return to throw them off the number one spot. So what they did was they designed a system which they could ship in parts and say, okay, the first part of this is now running and we can extend it later on. And the first system was installed with 8 cabinets, and then they did add, just a couple months later, they did add another 16 cabinets. The next year they did doubled the size, and on the in the end of the last year, they again did double the size. So what you can see here is the system scaled almost across one order of magnitude. It's really just a factor of 8, not a factor of 10, but this is something new. And the reason for that is it was using a very different network topology, which we'll see in the next slides. And also the design philosophy behind BlueJinQ was very different. I'm writing here that it was using custom hardware, which is actually true, but what we'll see on the next slides is the CPU design is based on standard architecture. One other design goal of BlueJinQ was, it wasn't just, not BlueJinQ, this was BlueJinL. So there are successors to the BlueJin line. First was BlueJinL, then came P, and now we have Q, which is probably the end of the line. Anyhow, so one goal was to yield a high flops per watt ratio. This is different from, say, the Earth simulator, which was built simply to deliver performance, no matter how much power it did cost, because power used to be cheap in Japan. It's different now that they have switched off all the nuclear power plants, but it used to be cheap. And yeah, BlueJinL, one reason was power is still cheap in the US, so it was not primarily focused on saving money. But one reason was you can only extract a certain amount of heat from a server room if you're using air cooling. If you're using water cooling, you can remove more heat, but even then it is limited. So the size of a system you can build is limited by the amount of heat you can remove from that system. This is one reason why they try to achieve a high flops per watt ratio. And one way to achieve this was actually to clock the CPUs at a lower speed, which we'll see on the next slides. I would like to move bottom up here for the design. So what you can see here is a single chip design. This packs two PowerPC 440 cores, delivering 5.6 gigaflops. And this is way less than the Earth simulator did deliver per core, per chip, right? If you remember that, it had at least 8 vector units, and it did deliver quite a lot more gigaflops. I'm not sure how much. Let's briefly skip back to see what the performance per chip was. Ah, okay. It doesn't tell me. Anyhow, so what I'm trying to say is this chip here was really nimble in comparison to the Earth simulator CPU. What they did then was they did put two compute chips on a single compute node, a compute card, and they did add RAM directly to the compute card. So this, in essence, is a very simple double socket compute system. Then they did put all those compute cards on node boards. Each node board had 16 compute cards, so that makes 64 PowerPC cores. Now, taking those node boards, they actually built racks. So in each rack, they had 32 node boards, and they even had a good idea for the cooling. So most server rooms still use raised floors. These raised floors are about 1 foot high, 1 foot high. And they use those raised floors for cabling. Let me just make some room. I already asked Georg Hager from the High Performance Computing Group to give us a tour through the server room from the RRZE. But basically, if you enter a server room, you will always see some sort of carpet which has holes in it. And on top of the carpet, you have server racks. And beneath that, you have about 1 foot high a raised floor, which is, as I said, used for running cables. But it's also used to supply cool air. So cold air moves through the raised floor, gets up. up through holes in the floor, and hot air is then extracted on the top of the ceiling. We even do this in our small server room, even though I have to say that our air cooling probably just produces hot air today. Anyhow, so you can also see this property here in the rack design. Cold air gets in on the bottom and it moves through the node boards and is heated up and moved out on the top of the rack. And if we skip back one slide, you can even see this in the rack design. They were putting multiple racks in front of each other, and this is why the front of the racks is slightly slanted to the back, because this is actually the cold air intake. So it's not just design. If you look at any IBM system, it's always black, it's always massive, except for the older ThinkPads, which try to be small. It's always, in a way, an impressive design. So the Japanese are not the only ones to build nice systems. Actually, some decades ago, when people were buying computers and they didn't really know what made a computer fast, IBM did add loud fans to their servers, because when they did show those to customers and they switch on the servers and it made a huge roaring noise, people would say, that sounds impressive, it must be a fast computer. It has changed completely today, so whenever you fire up a computer and it's really loud, people would say, oh, that must be ancient. But back then, people were impressed, and yeah, that's one way of making sales, impressing people. Okay, so as I said before, we had 32 node boards in a single rack, and when they were stacking the racks in rows, you can see here how the air intake and hot air exhaust overlaps with the air intake of the next rack. So in this case, they did not have cold air moving through all racks in one row, but each rack had its own cold air intake and hot air exhaust. Now, still one question remains, namely, how were they able to scale this system? How were they able to go from 8 racks to 64 racks? And the key to this is actually, sorry. Okay, let's skip this question. Let's just keep this question in mind, because I would like to discuss a different effect before that. Juice. And we still got some time, that's good. We probably don't have enough time to finish the next aspect, but I still would like to at least start explaining the basics of this. Who of you knows what Amdahl's law is? Okay, that's good. Quite a lot of people, not everyone. So I would like to briefly explain what Amdahl's law says. Basically, when parallel computing was still in its infancy, people were thinking, okay, if I have not just one compute core, but multiple compute cores, which performance can I probably achieve? So let's say I have, this is a function t, which should tell me the time necessary to complete a certain calculation. And let's say my problem size is n. Could be anything. For instance, the size of the matrix I'm working with, or the number of elements through which I need to iterate. And I have p CPUs. Then Amdahl's law tells me this time is equal to the serial fraction with problem size n plus the parallelizable fraction divided by the number of compute cores. So the assumption is I can always decompose my program into two parts, or at least two sets of instructions. One has to run always in sequence, for instance, to load a config file, even though one could argue that if you have an XML config file, you can probably parallelize even that. And there is some other fraction which I can perfectly parallelize, and there's no overhead associated to this. So the assumption is, if I'm adding more cores, then at some point, this part of the calculation will be meaningless because it's close to zero. So my actual time spent will just be the sequential fraction. Now, if I ask you, would you rather have 10 CPUs running at 1 gigahertz, or would you rather have one CPU running at 10 gigahertz? Which one would you choose? Sorry?
One CPU running at 10 gigahertz, at least if it doesn't consume a lot of power.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So consider everything equal, power consumption. And so Amdahl's law basically tells us use higher speed CPUs because you need, for the same performance, you need less CPUs, and the sequential fraction actually benefits from a higher clocked CPU, right? Because even if it's running just on one CPU, it benefits from the CPU being faster. So this Amdahl's law. Yeah. Amdahl's law is something pretty much everyone in high performance computing has in its in his genes, right? So it's something people always remember, which is sometimes misleading, as we'll see on this slide. This is also called IBM's slow computing approach. I was telling you before that one of the properties of the BlueJeans CPUs was that that they were running at a slower clock speed than Earth Simulator's cores. Okay, so in this slide, I'm actually using a bit different and slightly different notation from what I was using here on the blackboard, but still, if I try to compute the speed up depends on the time for a sequential calculation of the problem divided by the time required for the parallel computation. So we already have this formula here. So if I try to estimate the speed up, S, then that would be T of n and 1 divided by T, n, and p. And I can now, of course, I could now resolve this by using this formula. And then I would see that, in essence, my speedup is limited by the sequential fraction. And if I assume that this is zero, then my speedup would grow to p. I'm not sure if this leads to actually something interesting. Maybe we can take a look on the formulas on the next slides. What I'm trying to say is, yeah, here. This is the Amdahl effect. This is the formula for the speed up. So if I now compute this, I can see that depending on the problem size, I may see different speedups. So if I have a large problem size, where actually this parallelizable function, the parallelizable fraction is significant, then I can achieve a high speedup. If this fraction is insignificant, and the, if the sequential fraction actually becomes significant, then the speedup I can achieve, even if I'm adding almost infinite numbers of cores, is limited. So this is derives from the Amdahl's law, which is why it's called Amdahl effect. One problem we have with this estimation is it does not include network overhead. So usually, if I'm trying to parallelize a problem across not just two nodes, but let's say 20,000 nodes, I have to pay some overhead for communicating over the network, for synchronizing all nodes. And if I if we want to arrive at a more exact model, we also have to try to encompass this overhead, which we will model by kappa. Kappa of n and p tells me how much time is spent in communication. Ideally, I would like to overlap communication and calculation, but this is not always possible. So let me take a look on the time. Okay, so I would like to finish the lecture here. Because if we try to explain even more from the slow computing approach, we would lose that state for the next lecture. Regarding the exercises, I was asked before by Jan, who had to leave early, if we could change the due date for the exercise which I do today. And because there are no exercises to be finished for next week, the next due date for series 5 is in 2 weeks' time. I would like to say that if you want to hand in your homework today, you can, but you can also hand it in next week. The reason for that is I would like to discuss the results for last week's exercises before that, and which we couldn't do because we were having the exercises here, because the exercise built on top of each other, if you remember. And for the series of exercises 4, which were due today but are now due next week, you had to study the effect of non-temporal stores, and for some of you, they did not yield any benefit. So I would like to have some more time to explain how the actual vectorized code had to be written so you can then see benefits from using non-temporal stores. But so much for today. Thank you for your attention, and see you again next week on Tuesday.